Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, this time covering chapters 29 through 32 of part 2. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we get started, we actually just launched a Ko-fi website. It takes a lot of time and effort and money to help make the show. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who's donated so far. We're very grateful. We have a link in our show notes. Also, it's at www.ko-fi.com/the SE Files Pod if you want to donate.
It's also on our website, which I was very proud that I figured out how to do that.
Yes, that's amazing. Yes, it is.
Round of applause.
Which is very cool.
And thank you to the couple of people who emailed or DM'd us asking about this in the first place, because we had kind of talked about it before, but never seriously. So that was the push I think that we needed. And it's definitely going to help us with some of the annual expenses. So yeah, we're very grateful.
I was absolutely blown away by how many people came out to show their gratitude and support. It was so touching. Like, I was touched. So thank you so much to everyone who donated. And also to everyone who comments on the podcast, that boosts us. And also just to every single listener who enjoys our nonsense. Thank you to you as well.
Should we move on to the Q&A then?
Yeah. What have we got this week?
Can readers expect any unexpected dalliances or betrayals among the characters in The Running Grave?
So the agency, generally speaking, has a bit of a problem with the sixth detective. So we have five permanent detectives at the moment, and then they have a new sixth person. Having lost Nutley in the last book, they now have Little John. And Little John is not someone everyone takes to immediately, put it that way. One of the things I really enjoyed writing in this book, I think watching Strike manage this agency without Robin around was fun to write, because Robin, generally speaking, does supply a bit of emotional intelligence and balance. Not Strike's forte. He's ex-military, you know, he's used to sort of telling people to do stuff and that's it, it's done. And the other person I really love writing is Pat, the office manager. And for Pat fans, and I know there are Pat fans out there because I've spoken to them, Pat fans will, I think, really enjoy this book. And I can't say any more than that, but Pat reveals some unexpected aspects of her character in this book.
The very first thing that catches my attention with this answer is that she said there are five permanent detectives at the moment, because that must mean that we're going to get another permanent addition to the team at some point. I guess it could mean that we lose someone, but I feel like I remember her saying that the team would be permanent for the remainder of the series.
Yeah, I think that she said that somewhere in the Ink Black Heart Q&A. There's one where it talks about Dev and Midge as the two new subcontractors and that they'll be staying.
Yeah, so I think that must mean that we're going to get someone else at some point.
I wonder how many cursed six detectives we're going to get through before then, before we land on another permanent person. Because I've got to say, I enjoy the little conflict subplots with these bad fit subcontractors. Most of the time. Not you, Morris. But the Nutley plot, the Little John plot, I enjoy it. They're fun little diversions.
The next bit, when she talks about Strike managing without Robin, it kind of reminded me of Harry Potter a little bit, probably because I've been reading them. But when Ron leaves in Deathly Hallows and Harry and Hermione are left on their own, because it's not that they can't manage without him, but they do struggle with certain aspects when a key player of the team is missing. So it just felt very similar to me.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, I know you're both going to laugh at me because I'm showing my I'm so like Strike cards here. Logically, I understand what she's saying, that without Robin, he handles things more military-like. Maybe he's harsher without her and Robin balances him out. But honestly, I can't think of anything he did with the team while she was gone that I think I would have done differently. Maybe I need a Robin to balance me out then.
Yeah.
Well, do we want to talk about this fun bit here towards the end where she's talking about Pat? Because I'd like that she mentions that Pat has fans and she knows that Pat has fans.
I think that's the best part about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it says that she's watching and reading things online. And yeah, she's absolutely right. We loved Pat in this book.
I don't know how anyone reading these books could not love Pat, because at this point she's proven herself to be the goat. I don't see how she could get better, but I have a feeling that she will in book 8, and I'm really excited for it.
I'm glad that she's seeing that people like Pat. I'm a little scared about the other things she may have seen about people writing online.
I stand by everything I've ever put online.
Oh, yeah. Nothing that we would post. Just there are some truly hot takes out there.
There are some bad takes out there.
Many.
I feel like I can kind of sort through the bad takes that are
intentionally trying to bait people.
Good faith bad takes and troll bad takes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should we get into chapter 29?
Let's do this.
So in chapter 29, Strike does research into the death of Dai Weiss. The epigraph for this one, thus in all his transactions, the superior man carefully considers the beginning. And that is from Hexagram 6 or Conflict from the Book of Changes.
I think this one's pretty straightforward. Strike is going back and reading all of the old news reports about what happened the day of Dayu's drowning. He's considering the beginning.
Yeah, I definitely agree. When I was reading this hexagram, I looked at the trigrams that make it up, and I thought that they spoke to a bit of the larger picture, because hexagram 6 is made up of heaven, the creative, over water, the abysmal. The two move in opposite directions, causing conflict. And the hexagram says, the attribute of the creative is strength, that of the abysmal is danger, guile. Where cunning has force behind it, there is conflict. And to me, that sort of sums up the larger conflict that's getting underway here as they begin their investigation proper. It's between Strike and Robin, the creative forces, and the UHC, the abysmal. And the connection to the abysmal is strong with the UHC, because we know that Mazu likes that particular hexagram, the double water one.
This really reminds me of chapter 14 of Troubled Blood, the one where Strike and Robin go to the Three Kings and look at all the old articles about Margot's disappearance. Mm-hmm. The epigraph for that chapter is, in which they're written was with ciphers old. So both of these chapters are about going back to the beginning and looking at old news reports.
Oh, but in this one, Strike has to do it alone.
Yeah.
Aww. So getting into the chapter, we start it right away with Strike being adorable. It says, he decided to move down into the deserted office to pursue the train of thought engendered by his interview with Abigail Glover. He told himself this was because it was easier to work at the PC than at his laptop, but was dimly aware of a desire to sit at the partner's desk where he and Robin often faced each other.
Very cute. Remember how we were all thrilled 3 years ago when Troubled Blood came out and we learned about their partner's desk?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I just love seeing that he's seeking their shared space because he misses her.
Yeah. Going to sit where he can feel closer to Robin and maybe smell the lingering remnants of her perfume. This is absolutely peak lovesick pining behavior from Strike, and I really love to see it.
Me too.
I'm surprised that he didn't mention anything about smelling any of her perfume, like right after she left.
Like he did in Career of Evil.
So while he's sitting there, Strike is going through old newspaper archives and reading articles about the drowning and the inquest.
I like this little bit here that reads like an advertisement for the British Library Archive, because that site, I gotta say, it doesn't just have decades of newspapers. It has centuries. And I have spent many entertaining hours reading daily papers from like the mid 19th century. It was research for something I was writing, but it's just really interesting.
You weren't just doing it for fun?
I was kind of doing it for fun. That is kind of just like a fun thing that I do.
Peak nerd behavior. I love it.
This little bit here also reminds me of that moment from the Troubled Blood adaptation. I don't know if you guys remember this, but where there's basically a product placement for the same website for the British Library Archive. They're in the office talking to Wardle, and Robin explains how she found some news article by signing up for the British Library Archive. And you see Strike.
It's not Wardle. It's
the other one.
Layborn.
Thank you, Kens. They're talking to Layborn, and there's a little ad, but it just made me laugh because now I'm wondering if the series is somehow secretly sponsored by the British Library, or if Roland just gets the same enjoyment that I do out of old newspaper archives.
I doubt it's sponsored. One of those things where it's just like a real life thing that fits very well in the series. It makes total sense that a detective would be using this, and I bet 100%. It's fun to check it out and make sure that it worked the way she needed it to work for them.
Yeah.
And we see this in Troubled Blood and this book because, you know, cold cases.
They should investigate Jack the Ripper. I bet they could solve it.
That would probably be the oldest cold case they've ever done.
I think people have solved that as best as you can at this point.
Well, they haven't seen Strike. Give it a go.
God, the fact that they've managed to crack more than one cold case is just like, psh.
Best detectives in London.
I don't think there's a ton of what's actually in the articles to discuss here, because I think that these are just a really good way that she's giving us a recap of all of the information that we've been given so far.
They were very useful for me in making the Chapman Farm timeline that I've been working on and that I should have up on our blog by the time this episode airs. I've got it all laid out, but I need to make a very pretty looking infographic version, and I'm not so strong at the graphic design, but I'm going to commit. I'm going to have this up so that you can go check out the Chapman Farm master timeline by the time this airs as a handy reference. When will that be?
Thursday the 4th.
Of what? January?
Yes.
Yes.
Shit. Okay.
You're oh shit. That just lit a fire under my ass.
Oh my God. Okay. All right. Well, I've committed now. No
turning back now.
If you hear this on the 4th and it's not there, everybody at pools.
At me and shame me on Twitter. Do it. Public shaming. Let's bring them back for 2024.
I'm excited about that being done and up. It's going to be good.
It'll be a handy reference tool for when we're talking about stuff that's been going on, because it can get a little confusing.
I get confused multiple times.
Yeah. It's confusing. Yeah. There's a lot of moving pieces over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of names to remember.
I'm still so impressed by that person that was on Twitter that they had the whole plot of the book up on their wall and they were like trying to piece it out.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind fabulous. Of serial killer behavior. I'm worried.
I thought that was cool as hell.
I mean, it's cool as hell.
It's detective behavior.
It's a little worrying. Well, there's a thin line between the hunter and the hunted.
I've never seen a serial killer put clues up on their wall.
Well, maybe just the really good serial killers do it and don't get caught, you know?
I thought it was great detective work.
It was. Yes. I'm just being silly. It was very impressive. But going back to the chapter, Strike sees pictures of Dayu, and we see her described as rabbity in appearance, which I think is significant because at first it would make us maybe more sympathetic to her because it expresses a certain kind of timidity or vulnerability in addition to the fact that she's, you know, a 7-year-old girl. But all of us Strike readers, we're going to be having instant flashbacks to John Bristow, who's described as rabbity 5 times in Cuckoo's Calling. And I'm wondering if maybe this is some kind of visual pointer that all isn't as quite as it seems with Dayu, or with her death at least. I had a brief tinfoil conspiracy moment as I was looking this up, that John Bristow is actually another illegitimate child of Graves who's quietly adopted out by the UHC for cash. But I checked the timeline and Bristow was way too old, so that didn't work out. But it would have been fun if it had.
That would have been tinfoily indeed.
Yeah.
I do think this might be connected with Bristow, but only in the way that it's relevant to readers, giving us a clue towards the sibling rivalry or sibling murder that happens in both books.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So in Cuckoo's Calling, the sibling murderer is rabbity. In The Running Grave, it's the murdered sibling that is rabbity.
The articles also seem to be setting up interviews with the Heatons and the Graves.
Yeah, I think so. As I was reading this, I went to look up Alexander Graves' full name because I found the Tholey part of it interesting.
Ooh, yeah.
And for reference, the full name that's given in his obituary is Alexander Edward Tholey Graves.
What a name.
That's the kind of name, you know, the person's from money, like, right?
Right.
I thought that Graves would have a connection to the place where you bury bodies in, which makes sense. I mean, for this character. And apparently one possible origin is in the locational name meaning pit, but it's more commonly comes from grieve, meaning steward or bailiff. Anyway, so the meanings of all 4 of his names put together are to defend, wealthy guard, thorny clearing, and pit. And I think there's something there with Dayu, his daughter, dying out in the woods in a pit with no one to defend her, like a thorny clearing, or the church using Graves as a prophet to defend their horrible pit of a farm, which killed his daughter. Yeah, I haven't quite been able to make this hang together, but it's interesting.
Wealthy certainly fits.
Wealthy fits. And the fact that both of his first names mean defending or guarding, I think is significant. I haven't been able to make it hang together, but if anyone out there has ideas, let me know.
I can't remember. Have we brought up the parallels to Cuckoo's Calling and Rochelle with the drowning stuff? Because that was the first thing that I thought of when it talks about Strike knowing more about tides and drowning than the average person.
Tell us more about what her hands would do if they were drowned, Strike. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could definitely draw a sort of parallel here with Rochelle, where we're supposed to presume that a drowning is actually a murder. So we're looking at Cherie because we presume that she did actually drown, but we need to be proving it was on purpose. But really, we need to be looking somewhere else entirely, right? Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you brought this up, Kenz, because what this reminds me of most is the moment in Career of Evil when Strike sees the scarring on the leg that Robin got sent. And this bit says, How many times during his Cornish childhood had he been caught unawares as he stood with his back to the treacherous sea? Those who did not know the ocean well forgot its solidity, its brutality. When it slammed into them with the force of cold metal, they were appalled. And in Career of Evil, this memory of the power of the sea was much more personal and emotional, right? Whereas here, his knowledge is more detached, it's intellectualized. But in both cases, we have Strike's intimate knowledge of the ocean, given to him by his childhood experiences with his aunt and uncle in Cornwall, being used to sort of frame and understand a case that's connected to a much more traumatic and difficult aspect of his past. So he's using the good of his past to understand sort of the bad in a way, but projected onto the case, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I love that.
Also, on a lighter note, but still related to the sea, this bit where Strike mentions how the North Sea would be super chilly to swim in before sunrise. Has anyone else been sucked by the TikTok algorithm into North Sea talk with all those scary, videos of the giant waves throwing ships around toys, and it's like set to
the ocean already terrifies me.
Does it?
I didn't need those videos. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't realize that it was the North Sea that was off Cromer. So now I'm like, yeah, that does not seem inviting. I too would be suspicious about why you're swimming in the North Sea, because now that's, thanks to TikTok, a source of terror.
Even scarier.
For me. Yeah, so scary. Those waves are huge. That song is very spooky. I guess, you know, I really should have known where the North Sea was. I thought it was more norther, you know?
Norther. Yeah, I don't think I realized that either. Norther is, yeah.
Norther, like truther, but for the goodness. North.
Now I'm just thinking about Sirius swimming from Azkaban in the middle of the North Sea all the way to Britain, because now that sounds gnarly, like Animagus form or not.
Oh my God.
Yeah, how did he do it?
Wow. He braved the North Sea. He won.
But this next part is really interesting when he Googles drowned prophet UHC and then comes across the drawing of her by Torment Town on Pinterest, who we now know as Flora.
Flora has quite a few drawings. So should we talk about them and what we think they mean? It might be a little dark, but
I live in the dark. I am the dark.
First is the one of Dayu, and it says, as she'd looked in life, although in far more sinister form, the accomplished pencil and charcoal drawing had turned the rabbity face skeletal. Where there should have been eyes, there were empty sockets.
Does this suggest that the UHC changes her appearance a little in the drawings that they have, or the murals of the drowned prophet?
Oh, yeah, like the ones on the roof and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're described as idealized, so... Mm-hmm. I assume they give her like artistic braces to fix the overbite.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of old paintings where they edit a bit.
Oh, yeah. You know? They're very kind. Although I look at the ones with the Habsburgs and they cannot fix that whole genetic mess that's going on with the chin. Bless the painters. They try their best, but some things you just can't paint away. Flora's drawing, looking like Dayu did in life, suggests that the UHC also had actual pictures of Dayu around, though, like in addition to the murals, because how else would Flora know unless maybe as part of her recovery she Googled the same article Strike did and used the picture of Dayu to try and humanize her or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but the whole thing is interesting though, because they weren't supposed to have cameras.
Yeah.
I mean, we know at least one person had a camera, but this does say that photos existed of her, because where else would they have gotten the picture that they put in the newspapers?
Oh, yeah. So Base must have had a camera too.
Yeah, someone was taking pictures of her.
Yeah, to have a recent photo. Good point, plot hole. Probably not. Maybe? Just write it off to Wace's hypocrisy.
Yeah, that's easy to do. Or Mazu, I would expect, would take photos of her.
Yeah, both hypocrites. Most definitely possible.
Okay, next it says, a small, long-haired, naked child lay in the fetal position on the ground, face hidden, with two cloven feet standing either side. The image was surrounded by two hairy, clawed hands making a heart, a clear parody of the UHC symbol.
Cloven feet, that means hooves, right? Was Flora drawing the UHC as Canadians?
Wow. Offense taken. How dare you? Our hooves are not cloven. Our hooves are whole and beautiful. Because, yeah, cloven means it's like split hooves, like deer.
But for real, though, she's drawing them as... as monsters, right? It feels kind of fairy tale-ish, but scary.
Like the original Brothers Grimm fairy tales, like the dark shit.
Yeah.
Where the stepsisters and Cinderella are cutting parts of their feet off to fit into the shoes.
Very
gross. Yeah, I interpreted the cloven hooves and the hairy clawed hands as being imagery symbolic of the devil or Satan, who in the past couple of centuries has often been depicted with goat legs and horns. So basically as a satyr or a faun. And I think the satyr imagery also implies a connection with lust, because that is traditionally a connotation there. And so really interpreting this image, what the UHC calls the loving cure, is an evil inflicted by, as you said, Lindsay, monsters or devils, driven not by love, but by sexual brutality.
Next, it says, the same hairy hands formed their heart around a drawing of a naked man's lower body, although the erect penis had been replaced by a spiked club.
A clear reference to the sexual abuse that she endured, and it makes perfect sense that she would draw a penis as a weapon, because that's what it is. They were.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, next it says, a gagged woman was depicted with one of the clawed hands throttling her, the letters UHC drawn onto both dilated pupils.
This one's interesting, because I think that this could be herself in the drawing.
Mm-hmm.
So being gagged, maybe she feels like no one is listening to her, since she has tried to speak out. And it's as she looks on all the horrors the UHC is committing, that's why the letters are in her eyes.
That definitely, yeah, I agree with you. This image is horrifying to me, and I think you're spot on with your interpretation of it. The clawed hand strangling her, it's the church, the UHC has murderers having a stranglehold on their victims, literally cutting off the breath from their lungs with what they're doing to them. It's horrifying. These the images are just getting creepier and creepier.
We've only got
they're
a couple more
worse
left.
And worse.
I said it would be dark.
Yeah,
it's dark.
Definitely. It is. It is. Dayu appeared repeatedly, sometimes only her face, sometimes full length, in a white dress that dripped water onto the floor around her bare feet. The eyeless, rabbity face stared in through windows. The dripping corpse floated across ceilings and peered out from between dark trees.
Super creepy. It's the she's always watching thing.
Yeah, this is, you know, we're getting Ringu vibes here.
I think we all know that. I don't know what that is.
Oh, the Ringu, a ring. I'm not sure. I've seen it written both ways. It's the original Japanese version of the ring, which I definitely know you know.
I do know that.
Haven't seen it?
I don't know if I've seen it.
I think you'd remember.
I've seen enough of it.
Yeah.
Okay, last picture. It says, a meticulously rendered depiction of a group standing around a black five-sided pool. The figures around the pool were hooded, their faces in shadow, but Jonathan Wace's face was illuminated. Over the water hovered the spectral Dayu, looking down at the water below, a sinister smile on her face. Where Dayu's reflection should have been, there was a different woman floating on the surface of the water. She was fair-haired and wore square-framed glasses, but like Dayu, she had no eyes, only empty sockets.
Now, this image is the important one, because this is one of the keys to bringing down the UHC. As we learn, it's Flora's depiction of Deirdre's death in the murder pool. I feel like the sort of lengthy, detailed description we get of this should definitely point us towards it being significant. Plus, a reader who's paying attention, so not us, would have noticed that we've already gotten a description of Deirdre as fair-haired with square-framed glasses previous to this. So this is like a giant neon sign. You're like, oh, look at Deirdre. Something was going on there. It's suspicious.
On a lighter note, getting off of the creepy drawings that Flora did, we have to talk about the raven that hits the office window right before Strike saw the drawing of Deirdre.
Yes, the instant that this raven hit the window, my brain said, nevermore. Which is the iconic line spoken by the raven in Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. And I think there is maybe a connection that we can draw between the poem and this raven moment, because you can't write a raven banging into a window in Western literature without having that Poe thread in the background tapestry of what's going on, right? So I went and I reread The Raven and I had some thoughts. So the poem is about, a solitary scholar sitting in his library in the gloom, brooding about his lost love, Lenore. And here we have Strike. He's come down to the office because he's missing his love. love Robin, but she's not lost, of course. He knows she'll come back to him, which makes me think that this bird might actually be connected to Charlotte. In the poem, the speaker lets the bird into the room, right? And the raven, by repeating a single word, nevermore, drives the narrator into fury and madness at the thought that he'll never be able to forget his lost love, never be reunited with her in heaven. Now, obviously, what's different in this is that Strike doesn't let the raven in. The raven crashes against his office window and is blocked, just like all of Charlotte's messages and phone calls are. So the raven doesn't represent Strike's love for Charlotte. That's dead. It represents Charlotte's obsessive love for Strike, her inability to forget him and move on, her loss of hope of ever being reunited with him, right? And I think it's foreshadowing her death, as ravens are often connected with prophecy.
Yeah, I love this connection you've made. Whether it's intentional or not, it certainly works, because he has literally closed every door and window to Charlotte and doesn't let her in.
Yes.
I mean, also just random Googling about ravens, right? Say that it's a bad omen signaling death, as you said. Yeah. So I think it's super appropriate for Strike looking at this drawing of Deirdre as well, and of Dayu.
Yes. When he was talking about the poem, going back to Poe and ravens, but tying in with the sort of ravens as death, the raven is meant to symbolize, Poe said, mournful and never-ending remembrance, which to me really resonates with what the UHC has done to Dayu, turning her into a prophet, not letting her memory fade naturally, but keeping her artificially alive in this elaborate haunt. So yeah, I think it's also tied to Dayu, the prophet, like ravens are prophets. Oh, it's all coming together.
Also, ravens are supposed to be symbols of transformation and wisdom as well, which is super appropriate for Strike in this book.
Not to go on like a nutter about this, but one more thing that I noticed about the Poe connection. In the poem, the raven perches on a bust of Pallas Athena. If you're wondering why I'm saying it like that, it's because in Troubled Blood, we also saw a carving of Pallas Athena. It was the ugly clock that Margot left notes for Phipson, if you remember. And then Talbot used the asteroid Pallas Athena to symbolize Margot the victim. So we can draw a line between Margot and Dayu via Athena and this raven, or at least we can in sort of my twisted, tormented brain.
What would your twisted and tormented brain say the connection is saying? I mean, they're two cold cases, so there's a connection there.
Yeah, there is. I guess my thought involves messages, sort of, because Athena was guarding Margot's hidden message place in Troubled Blood, and the raven as messenger perches on Athena in the poem and shows up when Strike is looking at Flora's desperate artistic attempt to share what she's seen, to send a message, right?
Mm.
Messages that were supposedly from Margot and Dayu were sent in both books, Janice calling and pretending to be Margot and Wace using magic tricks to pretend that Dayu is appearing, but both victims were already dead and only Robin and Strike can uncover the truth, like Odysseus being guided by Athena, and Athena and the raven are markers of wisdom and truth-telling. Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is all nonsense. Unless there's a listener who's cleverer than me who can connect these dots and figure out where I wanted to go with this. But one more thing is I wanted to mention is the connection between ravens and the Tower of London. So there's a legend that if the ravens ever leave the Tower of London, England will fall. So at least six ravens are always kept in captivity at the Tower of London and are attended to by the Raven Master, which is an amazing job title.
Kind of sad.
The Raven Master's sad? Are we having them being kept?
Yeah,
their wings are clipped. They can't fly away.
Yeah, that's what's kind of sad.
Have y'all seen them in person?
Yeah.
Because those fuckers are huge. Oh my God.
Big fucking birds.
They are enormous.
I think they're pretty well fed.
I imagine they would be.
I mean, they have to put up with tourists, but otherwise they probably have a pretty cushy life, although it's not.
Yeah, but they can't fly.
That is sad. And the wild raven population in London was supposed to be wiped out in the 19th century. So there haven't been wild ravens in London for a long time. But apparently there have been reports of some nesting near London in this century. So I guess they're on their way back. So that's some good news that ravens are coming back to London and that one has crashed into Strike's window with a great deal of symbolic import. Or maybe just lost trying to pick up French fries.
That happens.
Mm-hmm. It does happen.
The whole thing is very creepy, though.
Yeah, it's a creepy moment.
It is.
It adds to the intensity, I guess, of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I would have jumped really high if this happened to me while I was looking at creepy drawings of some ghost girl.
I'm like, I'm about to be murdered by a ghost banging on my window.
For sure would have screamed.
Yeah.
Strike handled. He was very smooth. Very smooth in handling the raven.
We've seen how we react when we're startled on Zoom. they're screaming. So, yeah.
I wonder what it's like from that Raven's perspective.
Look, here's this fucking guy putting his office guy in my way.
I think that's the only time we see a raven in this series. Because I was trying to look it up. Any other time that the word raven is used, it's, you know, you're talking about being ravenous.
For chips, mostly.
Or
yes, that too.
I didn't say it.
We know what you're going to say. I think we all know exactly what you're about to say.
All right. Should we go to chapter 30?
Yes.
In chapter 30, Robin meets Deirdre Doherty's daughter, Lynn.
The epigraph: a princess leads her maids in waiting like a shoal of fishes to her husband and thus gains his favor. This epigraph reminds me of Lucy's story where Mazu led her to Dr. Coates. So I don't know if that's connected here where Robin is with Mazu and then she's led away to the doctor. It doesn't fit perfectly. That was just the first thing that popped into my head.
Yeah, I think this epigraph is definitely talking about Mazu and the way she preaches to the group in this chapter and to her larger function in the cult. She's drawing people in and keeping them in line, leading them as lambs to the slaughter to her husband for a share of his power, both in general recruiting labor and money and bodies for this cult sense, but then in the more specific, bringing him women to rape sense.
Yeah.
So yeah.
The hexagram as a whole talks about a crack in the foundation and that the wise person stays still at this time.
Yeah.
So applying this in a larger way, what Robin needs to do now in this moment is just go along with everything and not ruffle feathers.
Yeah.
Which obviously is what she does.
She does.
When the chapter starts, we see that the groups are being reassigned and Robin gets put in with the good group.
The cool kids.
She notices that the fire group is now made up of the wealthy or highly educated, and the people in the middle group are people who have trouble with tasks or they tend to complain.
That would be me, because I would be complaining.
That would be me. I'd be complaining like mad. I would have been a constant griping about this. I'd be so metal. I'd be like the most metal of all the metal.
So metal.
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd be like, just leave. Just leave.
Please leave. We can't take it.
Yeah. Do you think there ever is a time where the UHC didn't want to keep someone? Not due to illness, because we know that that's true. But for other reasons, they just don't want
this. So useless or annoying.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. I feel like I'd be the first.
How did you both feel when it said that Robin was enjoying the meditation bits of the day? Because it says she entered a pleasant trance-like state, which left her with a feeling of increased well-being.
I'm glad that she had a way that she could disconnect from the unpleasant feelings, because like God knows there's a lot of it and she's not getting much of a reprieve. But I hate that she was doing something that was tied to the cult. It just makes me feel a little ick.
Yeah, I felt that too.
I don't think I was ever really worried that Robin would end up actually brainwashed. She's too aware of the cult's tactics and her own mission for that. So even if it's from, you know, weird cult chanting, she can have a little hit of endorphins, okay, as a treat.
I mean, I think I'm a mix of both reactions, because I never thought that she was going to get brainwashed, so I wasn't worried in that sense. But like you, Kenz, I didn't like this. I'm not quite sure if I can articulate the reason. I think it had something to do with her finding the time to think as herself. I kept wanting that for her. So if she's always in lectures or so tired at night, I had kind of hoped that she could kind of pretend a little bit here and get her thoughts straight. So the idea that she was lost in this relaxation and not thinking was kind of unsettling for me. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I too found it a little unsettling. I mean, I love the way that she solved that problem of thinking for herself.
Can't wait till we get there.
But at this point, I was like, oh, I don't like it.
Yeah.
All right, next, Mazu reads a bit from the answer and then talks about, you know, some of the core concepts in the UHC, like the bubble world and materialist possession and flesh objects and stuff like that.
I think I have watched too many cult documentaries recently, because all of the cult speak here, it doesn't sound as weird as some of the real stuff I've been watching. For example, I'm never going to unhear the term spirit penis from the Twin Flames documentary.
Right.
That's just living up here for forever.
I still can't believe that was a phrase that was said out loud, completely unironically, with a straight face. Spirit penis.
I'm in the same place as you. This stuff sounds quite sane, really. I mean, especially because a lot of the things that Wace criticizes in this book are actually real serious problems. I agree with Wace about billionaires hoarding wealth, our culture's obsession with youth. Materialism is a real thing. And so he starts on solid ground, and then he takes you with him on the tracks he's building straight to Crazy Town. And along the way, you pick up jargon that sounds saner than spirit penis.
I think most things sound saner than spirit penis, but... I mean, I think that's their point. They want to draw people in with real issues that they might actually care about. But I don't think that Wace actually does.
Oh, no.
He's just trying to hook people in. Mm-hmm. Going back to cult terms, though, I quite like bubble world, just as a phrase. Mm. Makes me feel like I'm Glinda floating around in my bubble.
Sounds like a little theme park.
Bubble worlds?
Bubble world theme park.
That would be fun. I would go to bubble world.
I actually quite like flesh objects because it sounds suitably creepy, but it's immediately clear. I like it.
I still don't like the word flesh.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, I think it's kind of funny what Mazu is talking about with the golden prophet. Or she's reading from Wace's book, right? And it says, yeah. Margaret came to hear one of my talks. She told me later that she'd attended because she had nothing better to do. Of course, I was well aware that people often attend my meetings purely to have something new to talk about at fashionable dinner parties. Yet I've never scorned the company of the rich. That in itself is a form of prejudice. All judgment based on a person's wealth is bubble thinking.
When I read this bit, I was just like, yeah, I bet you don't squirm the company of the rich, buddy.
Yeah.
All judgments based on wealth are bubble thinking, except when you're sorting people into ranked groups on your farm based on their wealth so that you can groom them to donate. That judgment based on wealth is fine. Mm. That's not bubble world thinking.
But the thing about judging people for being rich, it kind of makes me think of Strike later on in that argument that he and Robin have about Flora.
Mm-hmm.
Robin should have told Strike that that was bubble thinking. That would have cleared it right up.
It would have made Strike laugh a bit, I think.
I think that Strike needs to maybe check himself occasionally when this comes up, because I get why he feels this way, but it's not always fair.
No.
As it's not with Flora. Also, I want him to get over this so he can take all that money that's his.
Oh, yeah. Buy a little love nest for him and a certain someone.
You know, we could talk about this more as we go through it, but the more I'm doing notes and reading this slowly, I'm starting to pick up on how things that the UHC says can actually kind of apply to Strike and his growth. It's kind of interesting. I'll point it out as we go.
Okay, speaking of bubble thinking and Mazu talking about judging people or not judging people based on their wealth, do you guys think that they make sure to mention that so that recruits don't say anything about the disparity in treatment between, you know, your more base level recruits and then the more wealthy and then well-known people like Nolly Seymour or Giles Furman?
Yeah, one would think that the blatant hypocrisy and favoritism would make the recruits do a double take.
Do you think the part where it talks about falling in love with Margaret and then explaining that when two sympathetic spirits meet, so-called physical reality dissolves into irrelevance is setting up the new recruits for spirit bonding? Because I think that's what's happening.
It's very much putting them in that frame of mind. And Wace is holding himself up as a model to emulate. Look how pure of spirit I am and how little I regard the body. Don't you want to be like me?
I seriously doubt that he ever slept with her.
Oh, absolutely not. Come on. No. He might have flirted a little to get her money, but
of course.
He liked Tom Riddle with Hepzibah, whatever her face.
Smith.
To get the cup, that kind of vibe, maybe. Ooh, oh, yeah. That's exactly that vibe, isn't
it? It's exactly. Yeah, it is.
Ew, creepy.
Then Jang comes in and is there to take Robin to see Dr. Zhou.
I was terrified by this. I was really worried that they were going to make her do a full physical examination or something. Like she was going to face her first attempt at an assault, basically.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I was scared of.
Yeah, I was scared of that too.
The chapter ends with Mazu thanking Robin for her service. And when Robin responds the correct way, Mazu gives her a cold, tight smile.
I think Mazu is slightly annoyed by Robin's ability to catch on so quickly. Mm-hmm. I think she probably doesn't like Robin because she's good looking and she knows Wace will like her. And her catching on so quickly also shows that she's smart. So I just get the vibe that Mazu is not a Rowena fan.
I think she can see that Robin's going to be Wace's type. Rowena's going to be made a spirit wife 100%. So Mazu is just like, well, might as well start hating you now, I guess.
And we also see that a little bit at the beginning, though, with Jang in the next chapter. Mm-hmm. He tells her that she catches on quickly and Robin sensed resentment.
Yeah.
I bet they also enjoy correcting people. So if they never need to be snapped at or put in their place, it's probably less fun for them, especially Jang, because you know he likes to do that.
Chapter 31.
In chapter 31, Robin visits Dr. Zhou, who assesses her fitness to fast.
The upper graph reads, 9 in the 5th place. One should not try an unknown medicine. That's from Hexagram 25, Innocence, the Unexpected.
Dun, dun, dun.
This epigraph made me so afraid of what happens in this chapter, because mm-hmm. he gives her something to drink. I'm so glad that it ended up not being an issue, but it scared me. And maybe this speaks to the larger issue that he cannot be trusted as a medical professional.
No, he cannot. Do not go to Zhao for medical advice. He is not a qualified physician. I think Zhao is, he's pretending to the innocence that the hexagram talks about, in the sense of being guided by the pure spirit of heaven. You know, this quote, devotion to this divine spirit within himself, he attains an unsullied innocence that leads him to do right with instinctive sureness, without any ulterior thought of reward and personal advantage. That's exactly the kind of character he's playing. He's like, oh, I take all aspects of medicine that speak to me because my instincts know what's right. You know, he pretends that this sums up his medical practice, but he's a fraud. I feel like green tea enemas are not what any kind of divine spirit wants. I rebuke a divine spirit that demands green tea enemas, because frankly, I'm not doing that.
It doesn't sound like something that you'd be into.
I'm not into it.
You don't think that would help you reach pure spirit?
If that's what pure spirit entails, I'm okay being a dirty spirit, you know?
I'm going to skip the green tea enemas too, just for the record. I'm
glad we're on the same page.
Yeah, we are.
Ken's suspiciously silent.
No, I'm good. I'm good on the green tea enemas. Okay, thank you very much.
You're all filled up for the month.
I think I'm good for like the rest of my life.
You've had so many green tea enemas that you just could not fit another one in. Literally.
Oh God, it's getting worse.
Okay, let's move on.
Let's move on from the enemas.
Let's move on from the enemas completely.
So Jang is taking Robin to Dr. Zhao, mm-hmm. and they pass an older barn with a cobwebbed padlock on the door. Is this the same one that Robin ends up in later, where she finds the hidden Polaroids?
I think this is, because then it mentions that she hides in the one barn that's always locked. And so when he's passing the old barns, it's like, there's a group of them. This one is padlocked. I think this is the barn. I think this is where they stick the possessions of people that kill or run away or something.
You'd think they'd set it on fire or something, get rid of all the evidence.
Yeah, I don't think they care that much. Or maybe, I don't know, they just got used to shoving it in the barn and then...
I mean, everyone needs a junk drawer, even a cult.
Yes.
Next, we see this whole encounter with Will comforting a small child. And when I first read this, I wasn't that upset by it. But now, knowing that he's in trouble for comforting his daughter, it's really heartbreaking to read this part.
Deliberately destroying the bond between parent and child is one of the more evil things that this cult does. I was curious about why her hair wasn't cut like the other children. So why has she been allowed to keep her hair like a little dandelion clock, which is the cutest image on the planet, by the way.
It is.
There are other children who are Wace's descendants, so that's not it. And it's not like Lynn or Will are high up in favor.
She's still really little, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she's like 2 or 3 years old, I think.
Yeah, she's 2.
So I was thinking that she probably just hasn't had her first haircut yet. I don't think I had any actual hair till I was about 2 years old.
Oh, really? Were you a little bald baby?
Yeah.
Oh,
so I'm guessing that they let babies just grow their hair until they get to a certain age, and then they give them all the.
But on a related topic, I am so amazed, knowing what we know now, that Lynn and Will were able to sneak around the cult's rules enough to build enough of a relationship with Ching that she sees him as a source of comfort and safety. Because it must have taken a hell of a lot of determination to take care of her often enough that she knows them, right?
Yeah, although maybe it doesn't take that much.
Mm.
Just a little bit of extra kindness from anyone and a child might feel more connected to them because they get so little of it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's made it even worse. Thanks a lot. That's
I think that's what it has to be, though.
I hate it.
It's okay. She's going to be okay. But Jang taking pleasure in getting to report Will for this and then going on to tell Robin that Dayu was his sister, so hypocritical, as is to be expected with these people.
Right? But
Him saying that he played with Dayu, though, gives me the impression that he's trying to impress Robin and make himself seem more important than he feels, obviously.
Yeah.
Do we know how old Tayo and Jang are? Because I am realizing that I've been picturing them as older than I think they must actually be.
If Jang played with Dayu, I'm assuming he's just a few years younger than her. So she was born in either late 87 or early 88. So in 2016, Dayu would have been 28 if she'd lived. So they both must be younger than that.
Yeah.
So I'd put Tayo and Jang in their mid-20s.
No, I think you're right. It's just I've been picturing them as older than Dayu, which doesn't make sense.
No.
But it does make sense because I'm picturing her as a little girl and them as adults. So my brain is just playing tricks on me.
You need the timeline.
I do need the timeline.
You need the timeline.
Dayu was Mazu's first child. So yes, obviously she's older than them, but my brain needs to accept that fact, I think. We're going to have a talk later.
Mm-hmm. When they get to the farmhouse, Robin sees a phrase in Latin on the floor that says, Stet fortuna domus.
Oh, too bad Strike isn't here to translate for us.
Yeah. According to Google, this means may the fortune of the house stand.
Oh.
I wonder if Robin has picked up enough Latin that she can make this out a bit.
She could probably pick up on the gist of it.
Yeah. Robin's here to destroy that fortune, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That house is going to crumble.
Okay. We get a brief encounter with Noli Seymour, where she's chatting and laughing with Dr. Zhao. She said she came up all the way to Chapman Farm because she needs a treatment. I don't know what treatment she needs that badly. I mean, maybe it's the same green tea enema.
Yeah, the idea of someone trekking from London all the way to Cromer just for a green tea enema is just way too funny. Oh my God.
Well, what is she talking about though? That's the only treatment we hear of.
That's what he specializes in, green tea enemas.
I don't know. Have you guys ever seen that show, My Strange Addiction?
That show's great. I really identified with the cheesy potatoes episode of that show.
Oh yeah. I think I'll take cheesy potatoes over that one episode of My Strange Addiction I saw once with the woman who is addicted to eating her husband's ashes.
What?
Yeah, I saw that one too.
Well, yeah. My question is, what's she going to do when she runs out?
Right? That's your question?
That doesn't seem like a sustainable addiction.
The one I was thinking of, though, there was an episode where this couple give themselves multiple coffee enemas all day.
What?
Why?
That cannot be safe.
I have so many questions.
I don't think a lot of things on that show are safe.
That sounds horrific.
So green tea and coffee, kind of, that's what this reminded me of.
Green tea, at least it's like got that healthy, like, oh, green tea, it's cleansing. Coffee, no.
I don't want either. Well, I don't want either. Not. Anyway, just wondering what Noli Seymour wanted, what she needed done.
I noticed that she doesn't have to wear hideous orange jumpsuits. And another red flag is the fact that she leaves in a cloud of tuberose. Because if you'll recall, one of the perfumes that Robin tried in Troubled Blood, Fracas, smelled of tuberose, and both she and Strike ended up hating it. Some quotes from Troubled Blood that seem particularly relevant. Living in a dense cloud of tuberose made her feel not only perpetually on the verge of a headache, but also as if she was wearing like furs and pearls in the daytime. And this one, like tuberose perfumes, seemed attractive until prolonged exposure made you crave escape.
I'm craving escape from Noli Seymour as well.
I too crave escape from Seymour. I crave escape from Chapman Farm. All of them. Mm-hmm. Get me away. So I wanted to bring this up at this point, but we got an email the other day from a listener named Katie, and she said, not sure if you've talked about it, but what do you think about Dr. Zhao as a potential pedophile? I don't think there's any hard evidence, but he fulfills the same role as the previous pedophile doctor at Chapman Farm. He's described as quite attractive, but I don't think he's ever mentioned spirit bonding. And Lynn is terrified of anyone going to fetch him or helping her when she's bleeding, and I don't think that's ever really explained. She grew up there, so there may have been some history. Kind of an unfounded stretch, but it popped into my head. Also, not related to the above, but his face is described with a significant scar from nose to mouth, but I don't think we ever learn what it's from. Just an interesting detail I couldn't place any significance to. Certainly no parallels to Shankar that I could see. Except that he too is a criminal, but not the charming, roguish kind. But I liked this thought, Katie, because I honestly kind of thought the same thing. I suppose we don't obviously have hard evidence either way. But Lynn's fear, combined with the fact that this farm is basically a private club for predators, and honestly, I could kind of see it being the case. I'm not going
to
lie.
I need to reread the chapter with Lynn not wanting to go to him to see what I think. I mean, at the very least, I think he's like Waste, where he doesn't care much about age. I would say that's probably true for a lot of them.
I feel like there's something going on with him that's pinging, like, what is up with this dude?
I don't know. I mean, we don't see anything really for it. I'm kind of intrigued by the scar, honestly, because...
Me too.
It's pointing this out, but we also see that Shankar has his covered in this book by a beard. It does make me think of Shankar as well.
Interesting.
Once Robin sits down with Dr. Zhou, he starts going through her information and the questionnaire she filled out.
He asks a lot of basic things, but one of the things he asks about is the scar on her arm that she got from Lang. It was a little concerning to me that Robin had concluded that one of the women from her dormitory must have reported this. The level of spying that's happening when you're undressing, even the women in your dormitory are going to tell on you.
Really ramps up the tension and the anxiety, doesn't it? Just like that feeling that even when you think that you're not being watched, your every move is being recorded and remembered and passed on to other people. people.
And this might be a stretch, but him asking if the scar was from a suicide attempt immediately made me think of Charlotte's actual suicide.
Oh.
I wonder if this is another thing setting up a suicide happening in that way.
Mm.
It's also making me think, though, because the wedding photographer in Lethal White had also wondered if the scar was a result of a suicide attempt. I wonder why J.K. Rowling gave her a scar in that place where people would wonder this. I don't know if that's a nonsense thought, but...
No, that makes sense to me, because the thing about Robin is that she hates looking vulnerable or fragile to people. And the fact that the scar looks the way it was, it might make people think that of her, when actually it's proof that she's a badass who fought off a serial killer. So it's sort of the, you know, she defies expectations based on surface appearances. Like, things are not what they seem. And Zhao is obviously probing for any trauma that the church might be able to exploit with these questions. It's pretty telling to me that he doesn't believe her, because they must recruit a lot of really vulnerable people with a history of mental health issues. And I'm betting he has seen a lot of self-harm scars.
Yeah. Also, I hate all of the questions that he asks her about sex. It's obvious that they are all to assess her value for these men, how willing she might be if she enjoys it. And then there's the lecture on how any and all contraception is bad. Mm. It just all goes to the larger picture of what they're doing here.
Yeah, you're so right. Oh, there's so much of it that you pick up on a second read. You're like, oh my God.
It's icky. Ugh. A bit, to say the least.
A bit.
There's this bit here where Robin lies about never having had an STD. Is this the first time we're hearing about this? Because I could have sworn there's a mention of this in a previous book, but I couldn't find it. But here's the line. Here's what it says in this book. It says, in fact, the rapist who ended her university career had given her chlamydia, for which she had been given antibiotics. But should we talk about this bit? Because I hear the whole chlamydia thing has kind of caused some wing flapping, I guess you would say, in the fandom lately.
Yeah, you're talking about the article that John Granger recently wrote.
I've heard a lot about it. Mm-hmm. I don't actually know what the argument was, because I don't usually read mm-hmm. them. I just saw a screenshot where women were called harpies.
I believe that the argument was that the chlamydia that Robin caught from her rapist could have gone undiagnosed and untreated long enough to cause pelvic inflammatory disease and lead to infertility. I would argue that this doesn't make much sense from a purely real world standpoint. We know that Robin went to the hospital after she was raped, and we know that she was there for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
She's from a middle class caring family who clearly did a lot of looking after her in the aftermath of the rape, including getting her therapy. There is absolutely no chance that she didn't receive testing for STIs in the appropriate time frame after she was raped. Her doctors wouldn't have just said, oh, well, off you go, fingers crossed you didn't get an infection. There's really no way to tell. That's not how it works. There are absolutely tests that pick up chlamydia, and they would have been given to her immediately after the rape, and then a couple weeks after as part of her follow-up care. Even if the NHS had somehow dropped the ball, to argue that her family wouldn't have gone to bat and get them for her, that everyone would just forget that she'd been exposed to STIs and say, oh, well, what can you do? It defies sense to me to suggest that chlamydia somehow slipped through the net and went undiagnosed for long enough to cause complications that would affect her fertility.
Besides her family and everything.
Yeah.
I remember reading that she had exams at the hospital. Mm-hmm. Like, I know you said that it mentions in Career of Evil that she was there for 24 hours, but isn't there something specific that talks about her being examined?
In Career of Evil, it says that both of them thought of what Robin herself had been subjected to in hospital after her attack. Strike had investigated rapes in the forum. Robin had a sudden miserable memory of having to pee into a sample bottle, eye completely closed from where he'd punched her, aching all over, her throat swollen from the strangulation, then having to lie down on the examination couch and the female doctor's gentleness as she parted Robin's knees.
Yeah, so she was, it tells us that she had those exams, and that would have been part of the test.
Well, yeah, they absolutely could have tested for STDs, thinking that the exams she's specifically talking about are forensic in nature to gather evidence, but she also would have received medical care, as is standard. And there are tests that can be performed immediately after sexual assault to test for chlamydia, NAATs, or nucleic acid amplification tests, which are the most sensitive. They can be performed, and I'm quoting from the CDC here, at the sites of penetration or attempted penetration for diagnostic evaluation of adolescent or adult sexual assault survivors. So yeah, the hospital would have provided Robin with medical care, including emergency contraception, STI tests, and anything else she needed. And I'm certain that she also would have had contact with victim support, who could help her arrange follow-up care for later testing and treatment. Because you don't have to just wait for chlamydia to show up and do a pelvic exam. There are swabs and, like I said, nucleic acid tests that you can do to test for it immediately and 2 weeks after.
I mean, the plus side of this argument, though, is that it counters all of those Robin is pregnant theories. So personally, I don't think either theory is coming true.
There's also the other argument, the sort of literary argument. John Granger bases his argument on mythological templates and biographical information and on the appearance of mad mothers in the books, all of whom, I should note, have lost children or are married to sterile men, not women who are infertile themselves. To be honest, I find this literary argument about potential infertility unconvincing. Because when I look at the actual text and the story that Rowling's written so far for Robin, it just doesn't fit for me. What we've seen so far is Robin's journey into herself. She's healing from a trauma that's derailed her life and set her on a path that wasn't true to who she was. She's been clawing her way back to who she feels she was supposed to be. And as part of that, we have seen a great deal of introspection for her about how having a child is incompatible with being that person. She's not willing to sacrifice the career that she loves for the demands of motherhood, so she is making the choice not to do it. So where we are in book seven, I see two options for the story that's being unfolded. Either Robin and Strike do in fact choose not to have children, and the story becomes about finding fulfillment and healing in one's vocation with the people you love, and how children aren't necessary for that, actually. And Robin's free choice is a powerful part of that message, and in keeping with Rowling's larger feminist project. Or there's the other path, where Robin and Strike change their minds or have an accidental child, in which case I think we would see Robin discover that with the right partner, one doesn't have to sacrifice who they are to be a mother, that it's possible to be a mother and have a vocation when you have the right support.
I know we lean towards no kids, but I think these two scenarios you're giving would both fit very nicely with the healing journey and then finding themselves. I think either way it would feel very satisfying. So I think you're right.
So my question is, what is it that this very unlikely scenario of PID-induced infertility add to Robin's character? How would it contribute to the larger project of Rowling's writing and the story that's being written? For me, the answer to both of those questions is it wouldn't. It would undermine the significance of Robin's choice in the narrative. It would undermine the journey to healing and fulfillment that we're seeing unfold. And I just don't think that's the story that Rowling's writing from what we've seen so far.
I also put that theory for many readers that Robin will have an accidental baby with Murphy in this exact same category. Mm-hmm. It goes against the story I think we're being told, especially when it comes to Robin and motherhood, because we know that parenthood is just different for women. Mm-hmm. For example, if Bijou really was having Strike's baby, which she's not.
She's not. Again.
She's not.
Again. A basic knowledge of biology.
I'm just saying that would suck, but no one would expect him to give up his job mm-hmm. or for his life to change that much. Mm-hmm. But when people argue that Robin is going to have a baby with a man she tolerates, yeah. you know, and is just kind of with, I don't understand it, because that would change her life that much. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah.
That storyline just doesn't fit with the books that we're reading, in my opinion, either of these theories, really.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'd bet heavy money against that.
Yeah, I think we are all in agreement on that.
Anyway, you want to go back to Dr. Zhao?
I do.
He's going right into personality tests. And
I know, and I'm excited.
This one might be the worst of all, because you know, it's very interesting that a wealthy girl happens to be a gift bearer.
Mm-hmm. Curious, isn't it? I'd be willing to bet that he says Noli is one too.
Oh, of course he does, which explains why she got the golden prophet tattoo, right?
Does she give her gifts after her green tea enemas?
In a sense.
Oh, God. Oh.
Fucking disgusting.
You just Ugh. Made that joke.
I'm sorry. You set it up so clearly, and I hate myself for making it.
No, it's fine. It's great.
I'd much rather talk about personality typing tests, because I, being who I am, I think I've worked out all of the different categories, or decants, as he calls them, for Zhao's typology system with their corresponding elements and prophet. So martyr is metal, and that's Graves, the stolen prophet. Mystic is water, and that's Dayu, the drowned prophet. Healer is wood, and that's Coates, the healer prophet. Gift bearer, fire, golden prophet. And warrior, earth, Anderson, the wounded prophet. So I think that I have the prophets accurately assigned. And the only elements I'm not sure of are wood and metal, because they could be switched. But metal represents firmness and determination, which I think fits with the story they tell about graves, while wood represents growth and vitality and nurturing, which I think fits with the image of Coates as like a healer growing herbs. But yeah, diumistic is obviously water. And I'm not sure what the point of me doing this is, except I really actually want to take this personality test and see which slot he puts me in.
I don't think it matters at all. Because if somebody fills out this form and then later he finds out, oh, this is a rich girl, that's going to change his perspective on anything.
Well, yeah, definitely.
Okay, so there's this next part he talks about true healing coming from the spirit. And right away, I was reminded of the Love Has Won or Mother God documentary, because that woman, even though she was the leader, was getting sicker and sicker. And they just kept saying that it was society's fault for their behavior. It's such a weird culty thing.
Yeah, I think it was in the documentary, it was something like she was having to process all of the world's negative energy or something like that.
And the world
that.
Just doesn't get it.
That whole documentary was so creepy.
It's a very culty thing, because it also reminds me of the Twin Flames documentary, where any problem that they face, even sickness, is due to their own spiritual problems. Everything is their fault. It's a great way to control people, break their spirit.
Totally. If people are busy blaming themselves, they won't start pointing fingers and blaming people who are really responsible or seeking help.
And the denial of medical science and treatment also serves the very useful purpose of dodging mandated reporters and safeguarding in hospitals. Because if your members never see doctors, then doctors can't get suspicious about whatever horrible shit you're doing that's showing up on their body and report it to the cops.
All right. So we have to talk about this moment where Dr. Zhu tells her that her qi is imbalanced and he gives her something to take for it. And it says, he chose three small brown bottles from the shelf, poured Robin a glass of water, added two drops from each bottle, swilled the glass, then handed it over to her. Wondering whether it was reckless to drink something of which she didn't know the ingredients, though reassured by the tiny quantities, Robin finished it all.
I was immediately back with Pez Pierce and freaking out.
Same.
I was on the lookout for this to happen because we had been worried about that. But I guess we can put this into the category of things we didn't really need to worry about. But I still wonder what it was, what he gave her.
Maybe extracts of something.
Yeah, it could have been extracts. Could have been essential oils. Maybe Zhao Shuls for doTERRA. he's a Hun. You know what I'm talking about with the Huns? Do you guys watch the anti-MLM content? So the anti-MLM calls women who are very into these MLM cults Huns, because they always start cold messages with, hey, Hun, haven't talked to you in 10 years, but I have a business opportunity, you know? And now I'm down a rabbit hole thinking about how cult-like MLMs are, multi-level marketing schemes. And, you know, at what point, when do they go from being a victim of predatory tactics to becoming predators themselves? When does complicity become culpability? Which fits, you know, with themes of the novel, if Zhao is shilling essential oils.
It fits with Abigail as well.
It super does,
Yeah.
After she leaves, she's again accompanied by Zhang until she slips away to use the bathroom.
This is when Robin realizes that the only time you can be alone is when you go to the bathroom. If I was there, they'd all think I had a condition or something, because I'd be going to the bathroom so much just to be all alone.
Oh my God, no kidding, right? I feel like I would be inventing an irritable bowel with a quickness.
Exactly. You don't even need the green tea enema. It's just...
Yep.
I'd be very afraid to pretend to have an irritable bowel in case they do try to treat me with the green tea. No, I don't want to risk it.
Maybe they kick you out for that.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that wouldn't serve Robin's purposes, but at least you can go get a burger.
I'm just saying, it seems horrifying. That's the only time you get to be alone.
So this is where we find out that she's been saving these little pebbles to keep track of the days, which is really smart.
Yeah. She could have used her journal, right? To see how many entries she had too.
Yeah, she totally could have. She could have started each entry with a word corresponding to the letter of the day, like my, the... why, when, FNS words. She could vary it enough they wouldn't catch on, or like make it the first word of the second sentence or something.
Maybe. I guess it could potentially look suspicious if she's going back and flipping through pages, because just thinking about the level that everyone is watching.
You don't really need to look at the one previous entry, but yeah, I guess it would look a bit suspicious. And what if they like give you a new journal and you're fucked?
I think I'd be worried about writing a code in there just in case. But the larger picture is that if she hadn't used the rocks, that she wouldn't have found the fish charm later on, right? So they serve their purpose for the story.
That's a good point.
And I guess if someone was watching a narration of my life, I'm sure that there were things that I would do where someone else would think, Why didn't she do it that way? Why didn't she do it differently? You know, this is just one of those things, I think.
Oh my God. Yeah. I wouldn't want to imagine someone criticizing my choices because I make some dumb ones.
I don't know. This might be a silly stretch, but as I've said, this whole exam, it worried me. It made me very uneasy. For some reason, her feeling that little pebble in her bra felt like a distraction, you know, something that grounded her and made her stay focused. It did for me. I felt myself focusing on that little rock.
It like the nail in the palm that Barclay suggested.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing at the end of this chapter is that Papa Jay's signed book for that guy, Danny, he left it for Robin. It feels significant that we got to see what he signed in the book because I think it shows us ways how Wace makes each person feel special, showing he remembers how they're sorted.
Yeah.
That's not the right word, but he remembers the results of their fake personality test. Sorted. He calls him son.
Yeah, it for sure feels significant because this is a spot where we get to see some of the ways in which Jonathan Wace is able to manipulate the people around him into being loyal to him and then by extension, the UHC.
Okay, should we go to chapter 32?
Yeah.
All right. So for chapter 32, Strike confronts Little John about having worked for Mitch Patterson. Mm. And then the epigraph, the superior man is on his guard against what is not yet in sight and on the alert for what is not yet within hearing. And that is from Hexagram 43, Breakthrough Resoluteness.
Yeah, I think this is another one that seems very straightforward. There's a lot going on in this chapter that our superior man is managing. Mm-hmm. He's got the Franks being super creepy and kidnappy. So he's on his guard there. He's got Little John being shady and he's setting up a meeting with Shanker to get to Jordan Reedy. So he's on his guard and he's alert all over the place from things that are to come.
He really is. He is our superior man. Resolute, solid, hairy. That bit's not in the hexagram, I don't think. That's just,
I think it's heavily implied.
It's editorializing, you know,
right.
It is implied.
Right.
It's heavily implied.
Yes.
At the beginning of this chapter, we find out from Barclay that it's both of the Franks who are involved in the stalking. Mm-hmm. To our question of who the real monster is, they are both actively complicit, as we find out. And I wanted to share a comment that we got from Wendy's Neverland on Discord, because I think it sheds some light on the relevance of the Franks to the main story. So they said, I saw some similarities with Abigail and Jonathan Wace. After her mom's death, she's mostly ignored by her father, her creator, and badly treated by her stepmom, which leads to many deaths, starting with Dayu. Frankenstein created the monster and then ignored him. And in a way, the cult turned everyone into monsters by making them all complicit. And yeah, the Abigail Wace parallel is there.
And yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this just a bit ago. It's extremely fitting for real life cults too. The things people do when they normally wouldn't have done them because they're in this situation.
Exactly.
This is kind of random, but I do really love reading about the agency out on surveillance, just on their other jobs. I know it can be tedious sometimes, but as someone who's dying to get back to London, it kind of sounds so cool to just be able to follow people all over the place the way they do.
It does, doesn't it? I bet there are certain stretches of London that they all know very well from having done surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
I would die to have that knowledge.
Strike and Robin are just kind of cool.
They're so
That's what
cool.
it comes down to. They're kind of cool.
They have a cool job.
Poor Strike is having no luck getting a face-to-face with Little John. I have to imagine that's because Strike would be able to tell right away that Little John was lying about being fired for a personality clash. And then we wouldn't get this fun, drawn-out drama, you know? I know you were believing him for a bit, Pools. What about you, Kens?
I don't think I believed him for one second. One, because he's got about as much personality as a sheet of printer paper.
That's an insult to printer paper, Kens.
That's
printer
fair.
Paper really is very solid.
I love a piece of paper.
Yeah.
But two, also, once we found out that he had lied once and he had that kind of contractor of the book sort of feel about him, it just made me question everything that came out of his mouth after that.
Yeah. At this point, as soon as I found out he'd lied about working for Patterson, I'm pretty sure I was like, oh, no, I was wrong. He's a baddie.
Strike stood with his phone pressed to his ear, thinking. His gut was issuing a warning, but his brain reminded him they wouldn't be able to cover all present cases without Little John.
Like we were talking about with the Q&A, for the last three books, we've had these unwanted subcontractors. And I know we love how much the team gels, but I agree that it is kind of fun having someone to cause trouble or annoyance within the office, you know? not Morris, like you said, Pools, but Nutley and Little John were very entertaining.
They for sure were. I kind of like that we have a rotating subcontractor of the book thing going on, though it does give kind of like a slight cursed defense against the dark arts position vibe. I wonder if we're going to get another permanent subcontractor before the series ends.
I think that what Joe said in the Q&A that we did earlier, I think it implies that we probably will.
That'll be fun.
I'm just thinking, like, is there a current subcontractor that's going to leave like Snape did when he took the DADA post?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love them all.
I don't feel particularly connected to Dev very much. I just don't know him very well.
I feel like there's a sense of mystery about him that makes me want to know more about him.
I guess you can throw Pat into that annoying new character thing in Troubled Blood with how annoyed Strike was with her in that book. Aww. I'm almost wondering what annoyed Strike more, Pat or astrology?
Oh man, that's a hard question to answer. I was just thinking about, you know, when TV Strike is talking about wanting to throw her out the window.
Oh, that was funny. So funny. I love, I need a door between me and Pat. It's great.
That was so good. Seriously, it was 100% astrology that he hated the most. Astrology didn't bring him soup when he was sick at Christmas.
You know what? Now that you mention it, astrology has never brought me soup either.
Well, of course it hasn't. You don't believe in it. Astrology is this like Santa soup to believers. It's like Santa. So you're missing out because the astrology soup is chef's kiss delicious. Mm. Imaginary, like that food in Hook.
Exactly. You're doing it.
But it's
it,
so
Peter.
Good once you believe you're doing it.
Oh, I love that movie.
So good.
I just had a thought about Little John that I'm almost certain is nonsense, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Can't be as nonsense as half the shit I've said this episode. So
that's, you know what? That's comforting. <You know>? We had talked about his name right before we were trying to make Robin Hood connections, but there are a few other Johns or Jonathans in these books. So there's John Bristow, there's Jonathan Ellicott, there's Jonathan Wace. So I'm wondering if this name Little John is saying that he's actually similar to one of these men, like a junior.
I get what you're saying.
I'm going to take Jonathan Ellicott out because I don't think he works, but of the remaining two we have John Bristow. Could work because he was also betraying people at his office by embezzling money, not trustworthy. And then with Jonathan Wace, it could be saying that both of these Johns, Wace and Little John, are frauds. You know what I mean?
You know what? I think this is really smart. I think Little John could totally be a pointer to him being a smaller version of the fraud Wace. He's smaller in personality. He doesn't have the riz, you know, but he's still a fraud.
He is, I don't know if it's nonsense, but maybe it might fit, actually.
Yeah, I think it might.
Strike's experience in managing people inside the army and out had taught him that where there was one lie, there were almost certain to be more.
This kind of makes me smile on a reread because I think it's setting us up for Pat's lie. Her big lie. I think Strike is going to find out that there is an exception to the rule, especially since this is followed immediately by a call from Pat.
Mm-hmm. Putting them in juxtaposition.
Next, Strike gets a return phone call from Alexander Graves' father, and they set up an interview for the next week.
I was feeling this sense of longing, just knowing that Strike was going to drive up and be near her.
Right. Oh, so close, yet so far.
I know.
So after that phone call, the Franks make a move, and these next few paragraphs really are terrifying because they're in disguises and they go to a sporting store far away in order to buy their little kidnap kit.
There should seriously be some sort of flagging system in all retail stores where if you buy a certain combination of items, the police just immediately show up for a welfare check. You know, if you're buying rope, bleach, tarp, that has to be a red flag.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm kind of surprised that that isn't a thing.
It should be a thing.
I would be so paranoid about accidentally buying suspicious combos of items. I might just coincidentally need a hammer and duct tape and chloroform. Okay. It doesn't mean I'm a criminal. It just means I have very specific needs.
If I saw somebody putting all these things in their cart, I would immediately turn to a detective on the spot. I'd be taking pictures. I'd find their car, get their license. I feel like I'm always just waiting to be a witness to some sort of crime.
The next bit is really funny, where it says, while he hadn't classified either of the brothers as geniuses, he was rapidly revising his estimate of their intelligence downwards. The younger brother kept glancing up at the security cameras. At one point, his wig slipped and he straightened it. They ambled with studied nonchalance around the store, picking up random objects and showing them to each other before making their way to the climbing section. Strike now started taking photos.
I mean, these two are like Crab and Goyle, just a couple of idiots.
Oh yeah, big Crab and Goyle vibes. They would definitely end up unleashing cursed magical fire on themselves.
Yeah. All right. Well, now Strike gets a call from Jordan Reedy from prison, which is interesting. He reminds me of someone here, but I can't place it. Is there another criminal type character in the books who gets really angry and defensive like this?
You know, it reminds me a bit of Brian Mathers from Cuckoo's Calling, because, you know, Jordan threatens to break his legs and calls him a cocksucker. Brian threatens to pull Strike's dick off and stuff it down his throat. I mean, they're cut from the
real shame.
Right. They're cut from the same cloth for sure.
Very charming, both of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Sorry, both.
Oh, man.
Sorry, I made her choke.
From the breast strips. Now it's all up in my nose.
Sorry.
Minty.
Yeah, I also remember making a mental note about pigs making him absolutely lose his mind, but I don't know if I gave it a ton of thought at this point.
Him smashing the phone headset against the wall is absolutely unhinged. That level of rage has clearly suggested to Strike that something worth poking at is going on here, because you don't get that angry about pigs unless there's some dark secret in this farm, right? There is some kind of horrible secret here to uncover, and Strike can sniff that out.
Yeah.
Strike then calls Shanker to set up a meeting.
Yeah, the highlight of this part for me is when they talk about Angel, though.
This just reminds me that I really hope that we continue to get these little background updates on Angel, Zahara, and Elisa for the rest of the series. And
yeah.
I'm just so glad that nothing tragic happened to her in this book.
Me too.
Oh, I know. And she got to see her biological father, but only after Shanker convinced him, which tells me this guy's absolute trash.
Oh, yeah. I have to wonder how violent Shanker's persuasive techniques are in this instance.
You know, if that happened, I'm not that mad about it.
Nope.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the end of this episode. What are we doing next time, Kenz?
So next time we are doing chapters 33 through 35. And in those episodes, Strike meets up with Shanker. We see the first appearance of Dayu. And Robin joins the UHC.
Ooh, I'm excited about the Shanker bit because that has some good stuff in it.
It does. That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.